My name is Khalil Maddy. Good to be here. As Em would say, good to be any damn place. Em's not with us this year. He's one of the ones that left this year. So I always like to remember him and all the brothers that left this year and all the sisters that left this year. The longer you stay around, the more I leave, but also the more come. It's a wonderful balance we have in here. It's good to be here. Good to be anywhere where people tell me to keep coming back. I really appreciate that. It's good to be out here in the middle of wherever I am. I came out dark, man. So I don't know where I am. I'm just trusting. You're talking about trust the process. So I'm just trusting the process that I can get my ass back out of here. All right. Costco asked me who I wanted to introduce me. And at the time, I hadn't sat through the introductory process y'all went through. I should have told him Richard Pryor. Because, y'all got a whole thing going up in there, which is good. It's good to keep it loose. As Dwayne always used to say, don't wear this thing like tight. We wear it like a loose coat, So that's a good thing. First time out here, I was supposed to come out here once before. I thought just to attend the conference, and it started snowing and icing, and I didn't come. Little that I know that Larry had me supposed to be speaking out here. So I'm sorry for all those that remember about 15 years ago when that was. If you're still holding that resentment, see your sponsor. a lot of friends out here, And I, in my heart, really wish I could recognize every friend that's out here. But if I start, I'm going to forget a name. And the longer I'm around, the more names I forget. But the more faces I remember, and the warmer my heart comes from seeing people here who I haven't seen in a long time and people I've seen over decades now. I mean, how crazy is that for a dope fiend talking about he's known somebody for a decade and they still like him? And they still talk to him and some of them still got the phone numbers. Simple things like that just shows how powerful this program is, man. That the stuff that we take for granted, we've been around here long enough to see people with 40, 50, 60 years, we see people with 30, 40 days that stay and keep coming back, man. This is a powerful program we have, a powerful program of recovery, and it's still in the life-saving business, In 1984, I didn't realize that. I was up in D.C. I had been married for 2 years. I had a year and a half old son. I was in the middle of a run, and I was working, and I went to lunch with a dude, and we went across the street to lunch to a restaurant, and I had my usual. I had a couple of beers for openers. I had a couple of margaritas with the lunch. I chased that with a brandy, and we went back over to the office, and we started talking business. And he called me up the next day, and he said, I realize that you might be like me, and I hope you're not mad, but I want to just kind of tell you that you might have the same kind of problem I have. And he suggested I go to a meeting. I said, well, what made you think I had a problem? He said, it wasn't the beer, it wasn't the margaritas, it wasn't the brandy. It's when you got back to the office and you opened up your drawer and you pulled out a bottle of mouthwash. He said, I thought that was pretty normal. People need to use a little mouthwash after they've been drinking. But then you started drinking the mouthwash. He said, oh, he liked me. And he risked my anger. And he told me about a meeting, and it happened to be a meeting like within 3 blocks of where I was. And I went to that meeting. Of course, I went there, with a honest, open-minded, and willing. Not. I think I put on a trench coat. I put on a hat. I put on sunglasses. I didn't want anybody to see me going to get help. That was like the worst thing for somebody to see me go get help. And I went to the meeting, and I heard people share, and I can identify with some of what they were saying. And it was an AA meeting, and that meeting helped me to understand that I really did have a problem. And a few months later, I moved 2 or 3 times and ended up back in Atlanta going to meetings, but feeling very, very desperate that I was really ready to go and use. Because see, after that lunch, I didn't stop at lunch, and I didn't stop after the business meeting. I went out at night, and I did what I really do. The other stuff was just to hold me over to do what I really do. And I figured I needed to back up, so I stopped drinking for that year, or however long it was, 6 months, whatever it was. I went to meetings, I listened, and I would go home at night, and I would smoke a joint so I could better understand what everybody said. That didn't really work. Somehow or another, I missed some of the message. But I did it, and my life got better. You know, so I don't judge how anybody gets to where they need to be in recovery. You know, some people do it through church, some people do it through psychiatry, some people do it through counseling, some people just cold turkey stop. I don't judge how people get to recovery, and I try not to judge how people stay in recovery. Because some people come around us for a year or two and go on, and their life is happy. Some people come here for a few months and go on, and their life is happy. But for me, I found something in here that made me want to keep coming back because it gave me a value in my life and it made my life meaningful. And it gave me a meaning that I could only find up inside recovery. But after that year, I was in a meeting and I was sharing, you know, hey, I'm getting ready to go do something now, you know. And a 16-year-old girl happened to be at this meeting. She said, you know what? She said, you need another kind of meeting. And she told me about Narcotics Anonymous. And all that time, I had never heard about Narcotics Anonymous. And I thought I was a pretty intelligent guy. But she told me, you need to go to a Narcotics Anonymous meeting. And I went downtown to DAC, the DeKalb Addiction Clinic. And the meeting was over there in these Woodruff buildings, in these fancy buildings. And I walked up in there, and Cabbage Patch John was the first time I ran into it. If you know, Cabbage Patch John, Cabbage Patch John was an old, white, redneck dude that loved to hug you strong. I was barely used to shaking hands. And Cabbage Patch, I walk in there, he grabbed me and hugged me. I said, oh God, what have I gotten myself into up in here? But I stayed, and I went up into the meeting, and Jules was in the meeting, and Dougie was in the meeting, some other guys were in the meeting, and David W. came through, and Nate Mack came through, and I was sitting there, and Jules gave me a pamphlet. He said, answer the questions on these pamphlets, and if you answer 10 right, you need to come back next week. Well, you know, I got 100 on that. First time I ever got 100 on a test. I answered all them questions. And I kept coming back, and I kept coming back, and I kept coming back. And I went over to the West End, and Don was there, and Wendy was there, and Plez was there, and Annette was there, and a whole Reggie was there, and people who raised me were there. And then I knew I had found a home. At that point, I was hanging out with the people who all my life I wanted to hang out with, and they accepted me for who I was, where I was. They made me feel welcome, and Wendy walked up to me at my first meeting over there, and I was standing after the meeting. I used to hide in the bathroom because that's where all the action was, wherever I went. I went straight to the bathroom because that's where the action was, but I learned not to go to the bathroom immediately in places, and I was standing off by myself. In perfect company. Wendy walked up to me and she said, you're new here, aren't you? I said, yes, I am. She said, would you like a job around here? Would you like to do something? I said, oh, they recognize my skills already. What an amazing, they have deep insight, you know. I said, yeah. She said, help us take out the trash. And I took out the trash for a year. And couldn't know I would fight you to take out, I had a job. I had meaning in my life. I had somebody wanted me to come back and do something. I went back every week to take out the trash. And after a year, I got a promotion to make coffee. And this is not an unusual story. Many of our stories are the same in this regard. I was a coffee maker for a year. And then they made me the GSR, and I got involved in service work. And I found out that not only could I be all right, that if I kept coming back, I got to be around other people all right. And just occasionally, I could say something to somebody that made them feel a little bit better about who they were. I found that there was a message of recovery that if I stayed around long enough and if I got out of my own way long enough, I could say something to somebody else that made them feel better, that made them want to come back. And that gift of being a valuable contributing member of society is something that I had looked for all of my life. That's why I used. I wanted to find out who I was and what the meaning was. I'm convinced in hindsight that I used because I was probably manic depressive because my drugs, I would go from heroin to cocaine. I would go up and down. I would ride the roller coaster, and it was probably trying to figure out where the middle ground was, which I could never figure out. It worked for a minute, but I couldn't find and keep that middle ground long enough. I couldn't hold that space, and I will always go back to the extremes. And now I came in recovery, you all told me that it's all right to feel the extremes, it's all right to go there, but there's a middle ground that you can walk. There's a path that you can walk where you no longer have to experience that roller coaster. And that path for me were the 12 steps. In working the 12 steps, I found that I didn't have to figure it out for myself. that there was, I think you all say, a planned program of action that would take me from where I was to where a journey would begin that would never end, that would take me to a place where I was all right on a journey that would never end. And that never-ending journey has changed for me a whole lot. There's an African proverb that says you can't step in the same river twice. You can't step in the same river twice. And for a long time, I thought the proverb had to do with the river, that the river was changing and was going downstream. As I've stayed around a while, I've come to find out that not only does the river change, the stepper changes too, that I change. The reason I can't step into it twice is because not only is the river different, I'm different. And that freed me up from being trapped in this illusion that I'm the same dude that walked up in here in 1986. I'm not that same dude. How could I possibly? You know how hard it would be to be in a program of recovery for 3 decades and to remain the same? You know what I'm saying? I mean, just by hanging around you dudes, we change, you know? Just by being in the environment of recovery, we change. But yet I want to hang on to that illusion that it's all right for me to act like I used to act. That it's all right for me to confuse genuine humor that Don Richardson embodied, genuine humor, for sarcasm. It took me a while to figure that out, because I used to like to hang on to my old ways clean. I used to like to do what I used to do, but want to feel what I like to feel now in the middle. And it just, I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it. Over time, my life changed. My thinking changed. My reaction to things changed. You know, some people say when you come in here, the only one thing you have to change, and that's everything. Well, for me, I didn't consciously change a whole lot. I was changed as a result of this process, as a result of working the steps, as a result of getting a relationship with a higher power. As a result of this process, my life has changed immeasurably in every single area of my life. Don used to say, when you come in here, if you want to find out what you're really about, write down a list of all you want in recovery, put it in a drawer, and take it out a year later. And you look at how much you cheated yourself, how little you really expected, and how much you get. And that has been true for me in every year of my recovery. My family, my blood family, sometimes we talk about like our families, you know, my family. Man, my blood family, my wife, my kids, my grandson, they are so very, very important to me because I value them, because without this program, I wouldn't have them. My marriage was breaking up. My wife was leaving. In addition to the dude that I talked about who 12-stepped me, I came home one morning after a run, my wife is sitting on the steps with a 38. She said, you come in one more time like that, I'm going to shoot you and then leave. It was at that point that what that guy told me about having a problem suddenly changed a little bit. I said, oh, I really do have a problem. I can't keep doing this because she's going to shoot my ass. So my wife, who's not in recovery, hung with me for that period of time. We developed a new relationship afterwards, and we've been married for 36 years, 37 years now. Dope fiend. 37 years married. I have a daughter who is a medical doctor, works down at Grady, takes care of those who are less than every day. I got a son who's a PhD teaching African American history at Wellesley College in Connecticut. I got a 12-year-old grandson. I retired after work. I mean, these things that I could keep listing out of the gifts that I've gotten in recovery are so long that I feel so humble. It's like sometimes I say, why me? I mean, you know, there's Why me? And it just is because. It just is because. There's no answer to that. But I will tell you this, that more and more my life gets boiled down to two things. Whether or not I want to get stuck on the question of what about me, or whether I want to work the 12-step. Because as we go through the steps, as I've gone through the steps, my life has changed, and I don't have to do 4 and 5 on a daily basis anymore. You know, I mean, I've uncovered stuff, and stuff has been removed, and stuff has been clarified. But the what about me is real, real strong. That's how my self-centeredness manifests itself. Somebody gets a new car. What about me? Well, I don't have one. You got one. Well, I don't have another new one. Pretty lady walking down the street. Well, what about me? Why don't I have her? What about me? Somebody dies. Well, what about me? What am I going to do now that they're dead? Every question that comes up, there's always this choice of whether or not I want to go back to this self-centered, what about me? What about me? What about me? Or whether or not I want to work a 12-step, because the 12-step is the answer for me. When I look at the 12-step and really, really look at the 12-step, that's the answer for me, because it tells me what my job is. You know, it says, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. I tried to deny that I had a spiritual awakening, because I thought it would be embarrassing. You know? Like, okay, you what you mean, you cured? What you don't talk to God? What you mean you had a spiritual awakening? I had a spiritual awakening. How the fuck am I going to stay around here all this time and not have a spiritual awakening? You know, I'm 65 years old, man. You know, I need to be all right with the fact that my life has substantially changed as a result of the change in my relationship with a higher power. I'm all right with that. I'm woke, and I plan to stay woke. You know, and if you don't want to be woke, that's all right, because I ain't judging your recovery. But I'm telling you, being woke is a whole lot better than being asleep. So having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, what do? We try to carry the message to the addict. And in the fellowship that I hold stand in, it says to the addict. It doesn't say to what kind of addict, it says to the addict. Sometimes it's the addict that are in our rooms that needs help, needs a voice, needs to hear the message. Sometimes it's the addict that's outside the room. I think one of the things that I find really interesting at this stage in our fellowship is that most of the addicts that we get are sent to us. How many people in here have ever done a 12-step? That's when you go out and find somebody and bring them in. There ain't nothing like doing a 12-step. It's a whole lot different when you sign in a sheet and they come to you versus doing a 12-step. And I'm really, really glad to see the number of people who did that, and we need to continue that we got to go and find folk and bring them to the rooms. We got to bring them to the rooms, because a lot of folks ain't coming to us through those sheets. And we need to carry a clear message. A clear message. I don't know that just stop is a clear message. They were telling me just stop for all my damn life. I just stop every morning. I just start at 10 o'clock. You know, so just stop ain't enough. Don't do no dope ain't enough of a message for me. Our message is the message we get as a result of working these steps. That by going through a clear process, our lives can change. We can become meaningful. We can develop a relationship with our higher power. We can clear the slate. All the stuff that's up in there is our message, that we can carry this message. Not any message, but this message to the addict. And we can practice these principles in all our affairs. That's where I balked. First of all, I was confused about affairs. I said, okay, I'll be happy to carry this to all my affairs. I'll treat her a little nice. I'll let her down easy. You know, I won't lie to her. I'll tell her I'm married, you know. And that, you know, I see somebody know what I'm talking about. Yeah. I'll be straight up. Yeah, I'll leave my ring on tonight when I go out. But that wasn't the affairs they were talking about. But it was a start. The wonderful thing I found about this program of recovery is that it takes us wherever we're at, whatever we're doing, and it moves us along the path a little bit at a time. I didn't have to start at the job. I didn't have to start at home. I started with the women I was dealing with because they said, you're a fed. But it moved me along, because a little bit of recovery is that seed that continues to grow within us on a daily basis if we water it. All of a sudden, I said, you know, I did that for a while and I found out that I wasn't feeling good being honest outside the house and lying in the house. So my own behavior led me to it. You know, it just didn't feel good no more. You know, to be treating the outside lady nice and come home and telling my wife I was at work again, smelling like fish. You know? And so, you know, after a while, I started saying, well, like, I need to do one or two things. I need to either quit lying and tell my wife where I really was, or I need to quit doing what I was doing. Became pretty easy because she still had that 38 that I wasn't going to tell her who I really was. My life became simple, you know, just, you know, simple things, you know. And then I was working. I had a great job, man. I had the dreams. I had the best job in Georgia. I really did, man. And I was at that job, and there was a guy that was on par with me. We were at relatively the same level of the organization, and I felt like he was trying to cut me, and I'm sure he felt like I was trying to cut him. I said, you know what? I'm going to fix this motherfucker. I'm going to leave. You know, the guy had really never really done anything to me. Certainly physically never done anything. Nothing really threatening. My job wasn't threatening. But I went upstairs. And I went upstairs alone. And I developed a resentment. And old Joe McQuaid, he talked about those resentments. Joe McQuaid, he said, a resentment. He said when he used to have this video recorder. And he would go around and record everything that people did to him during the day. And he would go home at night and play that tape, and that was his reason in to use that night. The resentments let him use that night because he had a good reason to use. But he said on some days he had a bad day. He would go out with his recorder and wouldn't nobody do nothing to him. Wouldn't nobody mess with him that day. So he said, I started recording what they was thinking. And that's what I was recording. What this dude was thinking, man. And I was ready to leave this job over what this dude was thinking. Yeah. And I had 10 years. I mean, you know, I won 30 days. I had 10 years. But it was at that point that I was ready to really work on resentments in a deep way. I mean, I had done a fourth step. I had done a fifth step. I had gone through it. But the practice of going through that in all of my affairs took me to a new level of recovery. And somebody told me the answer. Said, you got to pray for him. I said, man, I pray for him. Yeah, I'm pray he get out of the hospital after I whip his ass. But they say you have to pray for them. And not only do you pray for them, you wish them the best thing that they can have in their life. And if you do that for 30 days, it's a good chance your relationship would change. That's the first time I did it. It worked. And my faith and belief in the power of this program to change anything, deepened as a result of that process. I did that. I don't know if he liked me any more or less, but I know I was all right with him. I didn't leave the job. We talked on a civil basis, and life went on, and he didn't occupy that space in my head. And in so many instances, practicing these principles in my affairs outside the rooms have been really the lever that broke out stuff that I needed to get broke out. I used to think that I could anticipate and plan what my next struggle would be. And then if I had enough struggles, that one day my life would be all right. The biggest illusion that I had to shatter, and it continually shatters, is that one day everything gonna be all right. That one day, if I stay around long enough, if I work hard enough, if I do enough, everything gonna be all right. And it's just an illusion. Nothing will ever be all right all the time. And that's why we have these tools. That's why we have these steps. That's why we come together, because nothing will ever be all right all the time. But the shattering of that illusion took a long time, Jack. I kept thinking, like, after this one, after this storm, it's going to be okay. You know, after this death, it's going to be all right. After this hurt, it's going to be all right. And there's always something more. The difference is not whether there's something more. It's my reaction to it and whether I'm going to be all right. Whether I'm going to be all right as I go through it, and whether I can go through it in a principle fashion, you know? Because I found out that I can go through things a lot of different ways. I can go through cussing you out, and I'll get through it. I can go through hustling you, and I can go through it. I can go through it manipulating you and get through it. But I'm less than. I'm not this. I don't feel good about myself when I go through it that way. So when I go through it in a principled way, I think you're probably better in the reaction, but I know I'm better. See, this funny thing, this selfless service we do is so selfish, because we get better doing selfless service. We get better when we do things for other people. It's an amazing kind of paradox, I guess they call it, you know, that in doing things for others, we get better. John Basker, man, went to his funeral. I talked to a couple of brothers. I went to two funerals today. I went to John Bascom's funeral at 1 o'clock today. John was my buddy, man. We were good friends, but John was good friends with everybody he met. He had that kind of personality. If you ask John's best friends to stand up, half the house would stand up, and they all thought he was his best friend. But I was thinking a lot about John, and what John did was he came into recovery. He was 58 years old, and he had another whole life in recovery. Died at 79. The thing about John that was so amazing is that he transcended so many of the things that we see as being important. By transcended, he went above and beyond things that we thought to be important. He started shining shoes in Philly back in the 50s, man, and they would rub his head for good luck and shit like that, man. And John transcended all of what it meant to grow up as a black man in the 50s in Philly, and being in the Army and the Navy in the 60s, and being in the movement and all that, and he transcended that. Because John honestly believed in love. He believed in loving his fellow being unconditionally, and not letting those things we talk about in here that divide us. He didn't do it, you know. He didn't separate gay and straight. He didn't separate white and black. John even started to understand transgender at 79, 78 years old. I mean, you know, the fact that folk can be whatever they want to be, however they want to be it, and he was all right with that, and he would embrace people there. He didn't care about what you used, whether you were a drinker or a smoker or a shooter or a popper or a snorter. It was all the same to him. You know, he transcended, as they talk about it. We don't care who or what you use. And he loved people. He was my role model in that regard, because I'm much more judgmental, man. You walk up in the room, I'm going to size you up for about 3 or 4 months before I let you know whether you're all right or not. You know, but John would take the person when they first time they walk in the room, and he would hug them like he had known them forever. And I try to be more like that. I try to lose the judgmental part of me, man, because I came up, man. The dudes that raised me, the men and women that raised me in recovery were Vietnam era. It was hard. It was drill sergeant. Folks today, they ain't hearing that drill sergeant stuff, man. They, you know, and it's all right. They don't need to hear it. You know, you don't need to be cussed out to be told we love you. You know, there's another. We learn how to communicate differently when we're around for a while. You know, we learn how to put a little cut on some of that tough love we give. You put a little cut on. It's all right. They'll hear us. You know, because their relationship with the street is different. Their relationship with their family is different. Their relationship in their rooms are different, you know. So I don't have to call nobody, no stinky, dirty motherfucker, to let them know that I love them today. You know, I don't. I mean, there's, you know, I've developed different skills. But not only do I develop the skills because I'm different, it's important because they can't hear me if I talk to them that way. They can't hear me, and they're gonna go somewhere else where people gonna say, "Keep coming back. It's all right. You can do this. We love you. Hug me. Do whatever you all do in your fellowship together. I don't, you know, shake hands, whatever you do." But for the newcomer, to make them feel welcome in a language that they can speak. And that's what John taught me. He taught me to speak a language of compassion to everybody I encounter. And his language of compassion didn't end inside the rooms. You know, we were there, man, and there were people from all walks of life. That he was a servant of the people in all walks of life. And he taught me that if I leave it in the rooms and don't take it outside, I'll lose it in the rooms. You hear me? If I don't take it outside, these lessons that I learned about the oneness of the human spirit, about the people who are able to overcome whatever prejudgment they have, about whoever they're prejudging. If I can do it in here, I have to do it out there, because otherwise I'll lose it. It's not a question of whether I want to be nice to folk. It's a question of whether or not I want to keep what I have by giving it away. You know? We've seen people in here who, without our principles and our steps, would be arch enemies. Would fight each other, would cut each other, would steal from each other, would cuss each other out. And we find ways to get along up in here, because we understand that we share a bond together. This pain of addiction, this desperation that we walked in here, that we all walked in here, that bond of desperation ties us together. What John taught me is that outside the rooms, folks are just as desperate. They're in just as much pain. They express it in different ways, but the desperation is just as deep. It's the world is hurting, man. You know, and folks are taking sides and they're drawing up and they're doing it out of pain, out of deep pain. And John compels me to take the principles of this program. Thank you. John compels me to take the principle of this program and apply them in all my affairs. All my affairs, gets to say that over time, I don't get to put limits on who I see as human. I don't get to put limits on who I see can change. I don't get to put limits on who might become my friend. That it's possible with anybody. Because that's what I've seen inside these rooms. I came here, man, you know, I was scared of my own shadow, but yet I thought I was the toughest dude here. You know, Lee used to talk about it. He was an egomaniac with an inferiority complex. You know, and I've learned to change, and I've learned that those reactions to the world were false. Y'all taught me that gradually, slowly, over a long period of time, but you taught me that. When I say a long period of time, I'm talking about 31 years, but in the scheme of things, 31 years is but a blip. You know, we talk a lot of time. You know, when I came around, you know, it was 2-3 years was a lot of time. You had 2-3 years, you were a guru. People sat at your feet. People would take notes over what you said because you had got this thing. Now you go to a meeting, somebody got 2 or 3 years, we call it a newcomer meeting. Things change. My reality is that 30 years of recovery is but a blip in the transformational process that we go through. It's but a blip. Just a little bit of time. But look at how much we've changed in just a little bit of time. So I see the world as a hopeful place. I know it looks rough out there and there's a lot of pain, but I see the world as a hopeful place. If dope fiends and drunks and pimps and hustlers and bridge sleepers and stealers from work can change, anybody can change. I believe that. I believe that. The question is where I fit into that puzzle. And for me, the 12th step, it's up here somewhere, is where I fit into the puzzle. Because I don't have to go figure out Washington, D.C. I don't have to figure out Korea. I don't have to figure out City Hall. What my job is to try to carry the message to the attic and practice these principles in all my affairs. That's my job. That became my mission. I think that's why I was brought to these rooms, to do that. There's some other people that do a lot more than that, and that's important, that we become involved in all of our affairs, wherever that leads you outside these rooms. Some people it leads in a lot of different directions, and that's a good thing. But my focus has been within Narcotics Anonymous in terms of service. I was really, really fortunate over the last probably 18 months to be part of a work group that wrote a Narcotics Anonymous approved literature called Guiding Principles. It's a book on the 12 steps. We came together, it was men and women, straight and gay, from 7 different countries around the world. And we came together, we would produce drafts. Those drafts were sent around the world. Feedback came in, they were digested, and a document was presented to the World Conference of NA, and the document was approved. It's a book right now. It's called Guiding Principles about our traditions. There's no way in the world that I thought that I would ever be involved in such a process. But the bigger hit was that all I was doing was sitting in the room representing y'all. That I was not special. I was doing a job that I was asked to do to the best of my ability, and I was representing y'all, meaning all of the other addicts who could equally be in that room and do that job. One of the things I learned in the course of developing and working on that book is that as I had studied history, Narcotics Anonymous had several false starts. It started up and went away. It started up and went away. It started in New York and died out. There was Narcotics Anonymous in Lexington, Kentucky, which is where they sent addicts at that time because it was a crazy house, and they would deem us crazy, and the only place you could go would be to Lexington to get clean, and they had meetings there, and they were known as Narcotics Anonymous. They had meetings out in California that were known as Narcotics Anonymous, and they died out. They would spark up like fires and die out. And now when we look 65 years later, what we have today, it's truly, truly a miraculous occurrence that for the first time in man's entire history, a simple way is proving itself in the lives of many addicts. One of the people who was instrumental in making sure it stayed together on one of those sparks out in L.A., Jimmy Kay, said that the thing that we've got to do that the other sparks didn't do is to hold our traditions close. That our traditions are what will keep us together, enable us to develop, to withstand and go through whatever it is that might try to tie us together. You know, I've talked about the steps, but what I really learned in going through that process is that I can't work the steps without applying the traditions in all my affairs as well. Because they tell me how to get along with folk. They teach me how to get along with folk. They also let me know that everything ain't everything. That there's a reason why there's an Alcoholics Anonymous. There's a reason why there's a Narcotics Anonymous. There's a reason why fellowships exist under their own thing. And that to respect the tradition of whatever fellowship I go to or however many fellowships I go to is very, very important, because without the traditions and the respect for traditions, all of this will go up. The predecessors to AA experienced the same thing. In the 1800s, there were more people involved in recovering from alcoholism, thousands and thousands of them, and it disappeared. Why did it disappear? They didn't have the traditions. So my thing with that is not to step on toes. It's not to admonish. It's just to share the lesson that I've learned, that the traditions in all of my affairs have to work hand in hand with the steps, and that whatever fellowship or fellowships you belong to, guide and guard those traditions closely, because it's what's keeping us together and separate from chaos. The man put a slip up in here, say 20 minutes. That was probably 10 minutes ago. One thing I've learned inside recovery, and I try to practice it in all my affairs, is the most valuable gift I've got and we've got is time. If I can give you back 10 minutes, would you take it tonight?
Yeah.
I'm good. I'm done. Thank you for letting me share.